It's another beautiful Tuesday afternoon here in Johannesburg, and I'm sitting here with my colleagues Andrea Teagle and Ranjeni Munasamy, and we are here to discuss the news. And I can't think of many better things to do on a nice summer afternoon. Oh, actually, I can.
Well, you can be sitting watching TV and pulling your hair out watching the Oscar trial.
That's true.
That's always an option.
Well, a worse gig today is actually our poor colleague Greg Nicholson, who is in Pretoria at the Oscar trial.
Yes.
He is replacing Rebecca Davis, who usually does it, but she's in London. What's she doing in London, Ranjan?
She's sitting in a room with 1,000 other people. Writing a blog on the Oscar trial from there. So I don't think she's in a much better place than Greg is. And then our other colleague, Marianne, is in the Western Cape High Court at the Shriyan Divani trial, also suffering and getting shocked with the developments there. So I think out of the lot of us, the three of us have it best, eh?
Now, what do the poor foreign correspondents do? There's only one of them and two sensational trials going on that they need to cover.
I know. Well, it looks as if Oscar is the hotter news, because those that were at Divani last week have bailed and they're back in Pretoria.
Interesting.
Yes.
Even though there's much more interesting things going on in Divani right now, aren't
well,
there?
Well, Divani is more interesting in that there's complete denial of his involvement, and there's also salacious details, about his sex life, which according to Marianne has just been ruled inconsequential. To the murder case, but the thing is that with Oscar, it's so many factors colliding. It's the celebrity, it's beautiful people, it's the intrigue, and it's the fact that this country has been so swept away by it. So.
It is. It's a story for the ages, yeah. And we will be hearing about it for ages, no matter what happens in the sentencing today. Now, Andrea, I believe you have a fact for us. You like facts?
Yeah, I do. So I read about this earlier today and thought it was pretty interesting. So, you know how we all have, this image in our minds of the ancient Greek temples and statues, and you always think of them as gleaming white and very sort of noble looking in their starkness. And in fact, I was looking it up, and apparently they all used to be covered in really bright paint, which really kind of doesn't gel with how you think about, classic architecture.
No, that doesn't at all, actually.
And, all the architecture which has come subsequently and has been modeled on that, really has got it wrong. It should be covered in red. Red was apparently one of the favorites. It was typically red and blue and sometimes black. Mm-hmm. And the Parthenon apparently was shades of blue and also incorporated some green and red and gold. And you can Google some of the images where they've tried to recreate how the statues particularly used to look. And it's very, very different. I mean, they're sort of transformed into almost like colorful puppet-like figurines, as opposed
it's
to these really grand.
Because that elegance that they have is so much to do with their that whiteness.
Yeah, definitely. But obviously very, much more visually arresting perhaps in the color. Yeah, so they discovered that through shining like ultraviolet light and, using chemical.
So this is bad news for all the nouveau riche in Bedford View who are going to have to
do
a bit of repainting pretty soon.
I mean, that place, might all actually be an improvement.
Now, Andrea, you also have another story that you've been looking into for us about the church and homosexuality. What's going on?
This week there's been a meeting happening in Rome, which looks at the family in particular and topics like marriage and homosexuality and the use of contraceptives. And obviously we know that traditionally the church has been very, very conservative on all of those. In fact, very far behind the opinion of most of its followers, particularly in the West. Most people really just disagree that contraceptive is evil, outright think that they've got it wrong. So I think the discussion that it's generated is important in trying to move the church sort of more in line with public opinion now. So what's been interesting, in some of the discussion that's come out is there's been a sort of a more positive slant in terms of the view on homosexuality. And actually what the report by the bishop said was conceded that homosexuals had gifts and qualities to offer the Christian community, which, I don't really like that wording at all. It seems very sort of condescending. But then they hurriedly added that, they're not denying the moral problems connected with homosexual union. So they're not shifting their stance, but it is slightly more positive. And there have been senior clerics who've called for the church to you know, adopt a more progressive stance. So I think
is the difference that they're sort of not saying anymore that, or not implying that gay people are evil. They're saying gay people can be good people too,
right,
but what they happen to be doing is wrong.
Right, yeah.
I don't think that's natural. It's actually about good or bad. I think there's a slight change in the language. Mm-hmm. And we have on the line Father Russell Pollitt, who is a columnist for the Daily Maverick, and he has been writing on these issues for us. Father Russell, are you there with us?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome. We've just been discussing the developments at the Synod happening at the Vatican for the past week. And yesterday there was some news coming out from there that was indicating that there is a slight change of tone of language and discussion. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I think that's important, that there's a real turnabout on the way that things are normally discussed by the church. Last week in the Synod itself, we heard how, words that the church often used to describe people were kind of, the church, the people at the Synod said, well, these words are not relevant. They're not a good way of talking about people. And, you know, that we should move from that. And then yesterday there was a bit of a bombshell, because I think it's not just a question of changing language, but for example, speaking about people, which, you know, there's always been a difficulty with in the church, they said, well, we need to change the language, but they also said things like gay people should be welcomed and part of the church community, and their gifts and talents should be recognized. So there's a significant shift there, I think, which I suspect many church commentators were not expecting.
Mm. Okay, so the Catholic Church has about 1.1 billion followers around the world. So how significant is the Synod? Do you think that the outcome will have any kind of lasting effect on the life of the church?
I think the Synod is very significant, because I think that there's been a huge gap in people's lived experience of family life and what the church proposes. And I think that many people felt that the church was rather idealistic and unrealistic about what it was asking of people. So the idea behind the Synod was the Pope really saying last year, this is a real concern of his, and him calling the Synod. So, yeah, I think many, many people were very hopeful that things would change and that the Church would reassess some ideals and some maybe of the unrealistic ideals as people thought they were. And so it's been watched very carefully by a number of people, especially people who are divorced and remarried, especially gay Catholics, especially couples maybe who are living together, cohabitating, as the word is used. The church was frowned on all those things. And I think that we need to face the reality that these things, as society has developed, as people have been more open about these issues, they've always been there, but we can no longer speak about them in the way that we have before. And hopefully, also, there'll be a change in the way that processes take place. There'll be a change as well in the way that the church does things. I mean, significantly, in the language that's used, he talks about, in that document yesterday, he talks about acknowledging the commitment that partners make to each other. So it's not just simply married people, but it's saying partners. Well, that opens the door to all sorts of things. You know, when we talk about the commitment of partners, and we're not using the word marriage, I think that there's a strong hint there about the direction in which this is moving.
Father Russell, I've got a question. I've been very intrigued by the record so far of this current Pope. He's received a lot of praise for pushing the church towards a more sort of reformist direction. But it slightly worries me that the church, I mean, it's such a big institution. There are so many priests, so much clergy, so much administration, and yet it seems that one man at the top is able to exert a huge influence on its direction. Is the Catholic Church really dependent on just the Pope's will, or is it bigger than that?
No, I think it is bigger than that. I think what's happened is that in the previous papacies, Benedict and John Paul II, people didn't feel freedom to speak about these issues. And although many bishops in different parts of the world were facing these issues, were talking about these things, Rome was mute, and Rome was closed to even listening to or maybe even willing to discuss these issues. What's happened under Francis is that he has said, okay, let's have a frank and open discussion about these things. And so I think all that's happened is the conversations that have been happening around the world by clergy, by bishops, by lay people, I think now people feel a certain freedom to speak about them in a public forum where they know that some person from the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, which is almost like the watchdog of Catholic doctrine, is not going to be sent after them. So yes, the Pope exerts influence, but I think what has happened is that he has opened up this discussion. And this has also caused a lot of problems for him within the church. I mean, it's not simply that everyone's saying, oh yes, we enjoy what the Pope is saying and we hold to it. I mean, certainly a lot of people have come out, even if you look at the news today, saying that he's mistaken, saying that this is the worst document the church has ever produced. So, you know, he's got his opposition as well.
Okay, so what happens if the Synod doesn't live up to expectations and doesn't come out with any major changes and things remain the same? Do you think that, you know, that disappointment would have an effect on the life of the church?
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, I'm not sure that they can backtrack now on what they have said. I think this is an interim document. I think that, we are still to see this week through, and this document will be discussed, no doubt, at length during this week. But I think we will see significant shifts. I think that if they don't do that, indeed, there'll be a lot of disappointment, but there'll also be a loss of credibility. And I think the Pope's credibility, even at the moment, would be under scrutiny. I think it will have a very... And it's something to do with the trust of people. I mean, I think people feel that they trust now that something's going to happen to address some of the major concerns that we have faced as a church. And for them now to backtrack on that, I mean, would certainly not only, lose faith, but also it's an issue of trust.
Okay, and how much perspective has the African church brought to the synod, the African context and issues from here? How much does that impact on the discussions?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because I have been rather disappointed by the level of discourse from the African bishops at the synod. In fact, there's just been two bishops, really, that have been in the public view, as far as I can make out, that have said anything significant, and that is a cardinal from Nigeria and also the cardinal from South Africa, Napier. They mostly spoke about how a lot of the stuff in the pre-synodal document was not really concerns of Africa. They brought up the issue of polygamy and said that this was a real concern in Africa and that the rest of the church doesn't really understand this. They spoke a little bit about the context of colonization and how many things like artificial contraception they feel have been imposed on African people. But it seems to me like they never really addressed the issues of Africa, that is, social geopolitical issues and how that impacts on families. So I was rather disappointed. And also, like here in South Africa, we never really sent much information to Rome. So last year when the Pope called the Synod, he asked a questionnaire to be filled in by people all over the world. And those questionnaires were then forwarded to local bishops' conferences who collated the information and sent the information with their representatives to Rome. Well, I learnt unofficially that the bishops here in South Africa didn't collate anything and didn't send a document to Rome, but they said they were going as observers.
Someone needs to get them to do their homework, eh?
Exactly. And I think this happened in a number of places in Africa, which is sad, because that means the voice of the church is not heard.
To what extent do you think that the outcome of the synod might change the conversation around homophobia in Africa, given the influence of the church in promoting an anti-gay agenda in a lot of countries here?
I'm hoping that it would have a significant influence on doing that. I certainly know in places like Uganda where laws which were certainly unjust against gay people were implemented, it was very disappointing to hear that the church did nothing about that, because that's a matter of justice. And even if the church holds that, for example, gay people shouldn't be in relationships, before you even get to that point, the fact that people were being victimized is an issue of justice, and the church should have spoken out. So I'm hoping that it will change the minds of people in countries in Africa, for example, where there is a homophobia. There's not only homophobia in Africa, it's all over the world. I encountered that even in the States. But I think that it might soften attitudes. I'm hoping that the bishops on the ground do take note of the things that are being said, because ultimately it's about the implementation on the ground. And although Rome says do this, do that, doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to happen. And also in a number of places, you've got cultural factors to deal with. It's not just about what the church teaches, but you've also got cultures that you have to deal with. And so hopefully the church will also go about trying to influence those cultures and have a more open-minded approach to these issues.
Father Russell, thank you. We're going to have to leave it there for now. We have to move on to our next caller. We appreciate you talking to us, though.
You're welcome. All the best.
Now, we were just waiting to get in touch with Greg Nicholson, who's at the High Court in Pretoria. But in the meantime, let's go back to that other case that's happening here, the Dewanis. The judge ruled today that the fact of his sexual orientation is irrelevant to the case, and it should not be discussed. It's an interesting one. Is someone's sexual orientation relevant to the crimes they commit?
Well, I think it was irrelevant in as far as it goes to motive, because that's the bizarre thing about this case is nobody could understand why this man would have married this woman, brought her on honeymoon, and then arranged for her to be killed. And it seemed that the narrative of the state's case was that he was a gay man trapped, was forced into a situation where he had to cover his lifestyle, and therefore he had to marry this woman, but he couldn't kind of live with the situation and therefore had her killed. So that was their narrative. Now, if you think about the fact that that his sexuality is no longer in contention, the state is now going to have to come up with a motive to be able to show why he would have arranged, why would he have gone to the extent of coming to a foreign country, hiring this hitman and going through all this trauma. So I don't know what the state is, because I don't think they had a plan B.
Well, our correspondent there, Marianne Tum, said that when the judge ruled on this particular issue, the state's prosecutor, his face just fell. Clearly, it was a blow for the prosecution, and I wonder if they're going to be able to recover. Anyways, on to the next sensational court case in this country. We have on the line with us Greg Nicholson. Greg, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm okay. We're just taking a bit of a break for lunch and then back to court. So Oscar's back on again, and yeah, overjoyed about it.
You've been doing a lot of this over the last year or so. There's been Oscar, there's been the Farlam Commission. Are you feeling like you're fully trained as a lawyer now?
not quite, but I saw one of the recommendations from the Department of Correctional Services yesterday was for Oscar, in his correctional supervision, to also undergo law courses. Maybe Oscar Pistorius will be our next top advocate.
Maybe he could be our next correspondent. We could get Oscar to cover Devani. Now that would sell newspapers.
Not a bad idea, eh? I can see Sky News just jumping us. There's actually correspondents running around trying to ask him right now.
Greg, so what's happened today? Anything interesting?
Yeah, there is. The day started with the cross-examination of Oscar's former manager, Pete Van Sill, who yesterday really sort of went out to bat for Oscar, just saying how charitable he is. He read about an 80-page document showing all the sort of charitable acts, you know, he's done around the world with disabled children, sort of HIV/AIDS awareness around malaria, dealing with icons like Sebastian Coe, Bobby Charlton and such. And then today, Advocate Harry Nell for the prosecution put him under a little bit of strain, saying, don't all athletes sort of do all this charity work? And isn't it largely just linked to sponsorship and building your own brand? Mm. Would it be smart to sort of decline any of these offers? And Van Sill said, yes, most athletes do all this sort of charity work, and no, it would not be smart to decline any of these offers. But then Van Sill sort of still continued and said, Oscar's a bit of an abnormal case. He went above and beyond what most athletes do, and he really did spend a lot of time trying to particularly empower young disabled children, sort of paying on with his own money for their prosthetics and things like that. And now, of course, the importance of this testimony is that Oscar has in the past been a benefit to the community and potentially could be again, not in the same role, of course, but but he has shown that he can be a benefit to the community. So since then, it's been.
Is the idea here that if you've, you know, if you've been a pretty good person before,
yeah, it somehow mitigates. Yeah, your action.
It seems strange as a layperson looking at this. I don't really understand. Surely, you know, whoever commits a crime, whether you've done your charity work or not done your charity work, it's that crime that carries the sentence. I didn't realize. Tell us.
Yeah. No. You're right. So, if we take, for example, a guy like you, you know, who doesn't do anything charitable.
I think working for the Daily Mavericks, my charity.
Giving back.
Yeah. I'm Cliff Central.
It does feel like charity sometimes. So the way it works is that they do sort of look at what you've done for the community in terms of what you can have done before, because it adds up to sort of character evidence about what sort of a person you are. And if we add that sort of stuff to things like Oscar being a first-time offender, whether he's shown remorse or not, which his defense team are trying to say he has shown remorse, And whether he can be rehabilitated, if he's incarcerated in prison or something like house arrest, correctional supervision, we have to take all of that sort of stuff into account. So it will count in some sort of degree to Oscar's benefit.
I was watching a bit of the trial yesterday and today, Greg, and it just astounds me that it looks as if it's leaning towards that he would get correctional supervision instead of any kind of jail time. And the arguments that are made to support this is actually quite bizarre, I think, you know, that he would battle in prison, he wouldn't be able to shower, and you know, those kinds of things. I just find that, you know, if you think about the South African justice system and the fact that it rests on justice being done and being seen to be done, and I don't get the sense that this is the overriding factor in this case by the mm-hmm. evidence being led. What do you think?
Well, first of all, just a point on justice being seen to be done. It's important to note that it's the sort of public opinion and public perception can't be factored into the sentence. What will be factored into the sentencing is what's in the public interest, what's good for the public. And that doesn't mean, you know, all of us want the blood. That's going to be taken into account, but sort of what's best for us. And that's the court that will really argue that. But so, yeah, yesterday we saw the Department of Correctional Services, one of their officials called, his name is Moringa, I forget his first name now.
Joel Moringa.
And Moringa, that's right, and Moringa did argue that in Oscar's case, because of these things, like he's a first offender, they don't think he's going to be violent again. He's shown, he's already been through a lot of trauma, he's lost all of his business interests, he's already paid somewhat of a price, and in the future they don't believe he's going to commit a crime again. So, in the interest of trying to rehabilitate him, and this is one of the key things that these guys are focusing on, they're saying that the best way to rehabilitate Oscar Pistorius will be correctional supervision. Whereas if we put him into the jail system and we incarcerate him, it actually might go against society's interests and actually make him worse off than he is now. So they're sort of saying things like that he has to go through courses, you know, sort of with dealing with anger and, like I said, law, drinking no alcohol, and then being sort of under a type of house arrest where he could only go from home to work. And then sort of that testimony was backed up by Annette Vachir today, who said similar stuff, but she was the one who was more on this stuff that, you know, if he's disabled and in prison, they might steal his legs and rape him, and he won't be able to shower, and there's HIV/AIDS in prison, and things like that. And I think that's a little bit more circumspect. Mm. But she also did say that she's seen that he's taken responsibility for his actions and shown remorse. And this is where the crying in the trial actually comes in. The crying in the trial actually sort of has been factored into this sort of evidence. And they're saying she's shown remorse and has shown guilt because of that, which I think is quite interesting. But
he does look like a broken man from the outside. I mean,
that's what everybody's saying, that he's this broken man, and the idea of sentencing him isn't to completely break him and to destroy him, but in fact it's to rehabilitate him. And the interest of the community is in rehabilitating him, and that would be best served by a sort of correctional supervision, home arrest type of situation. But at the same time, I think Abbott Herring for the prosecution has been able to pick apart these arguments a little bit. Number one, the argument that Keir was saying that prisons are overcrowded and there aren't enough therapists, so he wouldn't get the therapy he needs. of all, he sort of picked apart her statistics on that. She said she just got these numbers from some website that she can't name. Hmm. The idea that he's going to, you know, people are going to steal his legs and he won't be able to shower and it's unhygienic. Of course, we know already that there's a lot of prisoners in, there's a lot of people in prison who have disabilities and they seem to be coping, at least we haven't heard too many reports of them struggling. And of course, we know that Oscar Pistorius also is a celebrity prisoner and he's likely to get treated a bit better than some of the other prisoners.
If you're correctional services, and you know, we know that there are problems with the prison system in this country, very serious problems. And it doesn't get a lot of attention because no one really cares about prisoners, but everyone's going to care about Oscar. Do you think if you run a prison that Oscar would be in, would you not want him to be there? Because actually, he's going to draw down the spotlight on how you do your work, and they might not want that.
I'm sure it'll be a bit of a burden for whatever warden.
Your call has been placed on hold. Please wait.
Well, apparently, Greg Nicholson has got a more important call.
Your call has been placed on hold. Please wait.
I don't think he's even aware that
he's probably still talking.
that he placed us on hold. But
let's let him believe that we hung up on him.
That's yeah, but you know what? This trial, I think, from start to finish, has just, you know, kept this nation in grasp, but also has brought so many societal issues to the fore, you know, on gender violence, on the South African judicial system, and now on what exactly the correctional services system is supposed to achieve. And you know, we have a constitution that is you know, humanitarian in nature. It is aimed at nation building. It is aimed at respect for human rights, but on the other hand, there's the interest of justice, which is a big factor. And when you look at the fact that there is a dead body in this matter, you have a grieving family that is seeking some form of justice out of this case. That it's not only Oscar; it's not about Oscar. And a large part of this case is around the personality and character of Oscar Pistorius. And you can see it in the way the defense is running this whole sentencing hearing. Is that, you know, he's so magnanimous; he's given back so much to society, and that they're almost arguing that there should be a special case for him, because when you look at the South African prison population, nobody makes these kinds of arguments, you know, that it's unhygienic. they'll be kicked in the head if somebody went and told the judge
and
that.
And Ranjani, I mean, looking at the bigger picture, like whatever Oscar gets sentenced to, he's been convicted, he'll have a criminal record, he will serve a sentence that a judge has deemed fit for the crime, and yet we have these other issues in South Africa. Marikana springs to mind,
yes.
Jacob Zuma springs to mind. These are issues that aren't being held accountable in a court of law. What do you think is going on here?
Yeah, but you see, this is what I wrote about today, is that there's a general lack of accountability in this country. And with the Jacob Zuma matter and the Oscar Pistorius matter, there is a deliberate effort to paint them both as victims of circumstance, that nothing that they have done have led them to the situation they find themselves in. So therefore, you find with the Nkandla matter, for example, that you find ANC MPs in Parliament tripping over themselves, trying to say Jacob Zuma shouldn't be asked any difficult questions, he shouldn't be made to pay back the money because this happened to him. And the fact that he and his family benefits is it doesn't really matter because they didn't ask for these things. You also have the case with his corruption charges, you know, these things are forever hanging over him. But and they all these questions in the weekend press, there were reports that he labeled the corruption case against him as being part of a Western paradigm. So he doesn't even accept that anything wrong happened. And that's a fundamental problem with our society. It's what's wrong with the Marikana matter, because it's now 26 months since it's happened, and there's not a single person who's been put on trial for Marikana. And there's no demand from society for any kind of justice for that. Those were 34 people like us, citizens of this country. You know, they lost their lives at the hands of the police, the people who are meant to protect them. And there's no kind of demand from society before any kind of accountability from the state. Everybody's just sitting through this commission, and no matter what it finds, it looks like we're going to accept it. And now with this Pistorius case, he already has a lesser conviction than what was expected. And now it looks that from the way the sentencing hearing is, that, you know, he can get 3 years of house arrest, which means he gets to get up in his own bed, wander around his uncle's house, and for 16 hours a month, which is basically 8 hours broken over 2 days, he has to go and clean a museum. That is outrageous. I mean, you know, I used to get worse punishment, like, you know, from my father for going late to school.
And it's almost demeaning. I mean, you think that cleaning a museum is a punishment, and yet that is a livelihood for many people in this country. It's almost as if you're saying that. No,
yes,
exactly.
No.
I believe we have Greg back on the line.
We do. And so, I mean, just before I go back into court, I thought I might give you a little bit of a preview of what the prosecution's argument in mitigation of sentencing is. Or is likely to be. Mm-hmm. First of all,
you mean in aggravation of sentence, right? The prosecution.
Yes, that's right, in aggravation of sentence. So, Harry Nell has continued to talk about the degree of negligence shown, saying that, and this is part of the judgment, that Oscar Pistorius got his gun, walked towards the bathroom with the intention to shoot somebody, put 4 bullets through a locked door. And he's going to argue that is a very high sort of degree of negligence, and Oscar should serve maximum jail time. We're also likely to see, I think, one of the Steinkamp family members, perhaps Reva's cousin, testify for the prosecution and just talk about the carnage that's run through the Steinkamp family now Reva's being killed. We're sort of sitting on our seats to see what happens here.
Thanks, Greg. Good luck today. We're enjoying your reports. You're doing an admirable Rebecca Davis impression while you're there.
Thanks, Simon.
All right, so that was Greg Nicholson from Oscar. What else is on the agenda
today?
Well,
why don't you tell us about your trip to Mozambique? I believe you were there last week.
I was indeed. It was one of those working holidays, shall we call it. Mozambique is going to have elections tomorrow. So I went up last week just to have a little look around, talk to some people, see what is going to happen. And, you know, it's a fascinating place because in many ways it's very similar to South Africa. You know, you've got this liberation movement that became the ruling party, and they've sat in power for the last 30-40 years. And the country, you know, it's okay. It could be worse, but the economic growth that they've got, and it's impressive economic growth, it's all staying in this little segment of society right at the top, and the lives of the people at the bottom aren't changing, and this is the majority. Now, what the ANC needs to watch for, you know, ANC should be taking lessons from this, because actually what you're seeing in Mozambique is, after all this time, the people at the bottom are starting to say, no, we don't want to vote for you anymore. Mm. We are not of the generation that fought the independence struggle. We don't owe you any ties of blood or comradeship or history. We want a government that provides for us, and you are unable to do so. So we are going to see who else we can vote for. And there are two other parties that are really in with a shout. Not individually, I don't think, but together they might just be able to pull off an upset. And the way Mozambique works is you vote for your president directly. So you cast your vote for that particular man, unlike in South Africa where you vote for the parliamentarians and the party. So, and there's two rounds. So if the ruling party wins more than 50% in the first round, then they will be elected, finished, and clear. If they win under 50%, so even if they get 49% and the two opposition parties between them get 51%, then it'll go to a second round. And there'll be the lowest ranking opposition party will fall away. So now what that means is, say one party gets 36 and the other party got 15. No, my maths is a bit shaky. That adds up to 51, right? Yeah. So the smaller party will fall away, but then all those voters who voted for the opposition party, they're not going to change their vote to the ruling party. They're going to change their vote to the other opposition party. So if it goes to a second round, the chances of the ruling party losing are very, very high indeed. And this is going to cause a seismic shift in the way Mozambique works.
But I think it's also a good wake-up call for the governments which emanated from liberation movements in Southern Africa. Mm. Because there is kind of an attitude that we can rule forever and that our liberation credentials will always carry us through. But there's clearly, even in South Africa now, that the memory of apartheid is receding. And also the glory days of the liberation movement are also receding, you know, the memory of it. And now it's being muddied by the business of governance and everything else that comes with it, everything that that comes with political office, So I think that's exactly what the governments of Zimbabwe, of Namibia, of South Africa need right now, is for somebody in the neighborhood to get a hard kick in the head.
Yes. it'll really be, I mean, let's think about it. In SADC, are all the SADC countries ruled by their respective liberation movements?
Yes. Botswana,
Namibia, South Africa, Mozambique,
Zimbabwe.
Swaziland, still a kingdom.
Yeah.
Lesotho's had a couple changes, but they're so small to be.
I love how we like just forget about the things. Well, they're good and bad sides of it. I mean, we've forgotten about Lesotho, although it had like a major crash and burn in our neighborhood.
Let's be honest, it's a province that we don't have to pay for.
Yes.
That's why we keep it around.
Yeah, but the other tragedy is also, I was listening earlier on that former president of Nigeria, Olusegun Obasanjo, was saying that people should give up on trying to find the girls because it's now 6 months since they're missing. And he was saying that there's no possible way to find them. And I was horrified to find that he was saying that some of them are pregnant and, that their families can't reclaim them. They're gone for good. And, you know, that's also fallen off the international radar right now.
Well, I'm a little bit frustrated by the story, actually, and this whole, 6 months since the girls disappeared narrative that we're hearing today. For one thing, it took the international media and took most of the South African media 2 months to realize the girls were missing. Mm. Okay, and I will say the Daily Maverick had written about it the week after. Like, if you're paying attention, you know this stuff happens. But no one was paying attention. And still no one's paying attention because hundreds of other girls have gone missing in northeastern Nigeria since that time. Mm. Hundreds of other boys have gone missing. Hundreds of people have been killed. This was not one isolated incident of girls being kidnapped. This is part of a much bigger picture of what's going on. So to almost make a fetish of this one incident is crazy. And, and it's missing, what's the phrase, missing the woods for the tree.
Yeah. There is a different narrative for stories in Africa and stories elsewhere in the world. And I think that nothing demonstrates that better than the Ebola story. Mm. Because 4,000 people have died. And now one person has died in the US and one person in Europe. And suddenly it's a global crisis.
Exactly.
And there are all sorts of crisis measures being undertaken for it. I think that there is more of a response now to get aid into the countries in Africa, but still, it's the way the story that is being told that I think is the problem.
And you got to look at the way that media is structured on the continent in particular. And I think that this Ebola issue, that this is a media problem. International bodies, the World Health Organization declared this an international priority emergency, which is its highest level, 3 months ago. The UN has been sending as much assistance as it can. There has been an international response, but there hasn't been much media response. And in Africa, the reason for that is how we get our news about the rest of the continent. Mm. And it's not from the continent itself. It all comes via wire agencies or foreign newspapers who they send correspondents to Liberia, if they do. They write the story for their audience in Europe or America, and then we get it in South Africa. And you look at every single print media in this country, almost all of the Africa coverage comes from wires or from tie-ins with foreign publications. And this is a real problem because it's not a South African news editor sitting and saying, you know what, this is a big African story, we need to cover it. Mm. Because he's looking at the headlines coming in on his wire feed and, there's no Ebola headlines, so he doesn't put an Ebola story. It's as simple as that.
But also, how much have African nations been dealing with this as a continental issue rather than leaving the countries that have been afflicted to deal with it on their own? Because, I mean, I haven't heard any kind of strong messaging from the AU, perhaps there is, but I'm not getting the kind of rallying from all the countries on the continent on this. But,
I mean, again, this is part of it. The AU can issue as many statements as it likes, and it has. You only get that feeling that there's a huge response when you're seeing it in multiple media outlets. That's where most individuals get, you know, that's how they know what's happening. Mm. And if no one, you know, I'm on with the tree metaphors today. But if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, if the AU says something in Addis Ababa and no one reports it, have they really said it? It's that kind of conundrum. There has been a West African response. They met very early on to try and come up with a regional plan to contain this. And it's kind of worked. In terms of keeping it within Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia, there have been outbreaks in other places, but those have been controlled. The AU has responded. It's sent, I think, something like 100 medics and put in $1 million, which is nowhere near enough. Mm. But also, it doesn't have the capacity. I mean, it simply doesn't have more money.
But I also think this is a frightening story to tell. And I was with some foreign correspondents on Friday night, and they were saying that the international news agencies are battling to get people to actually go there because people are frightened. Photographers don't want to go. They're really, really frightened, especially after the freelancer from the US contracted it. And it doesn't have that kind of pull that you get from, the war zone correspondents, those who kind of move around the war zones. For some reason, people would prefer being blown up and being shot in the head or beheaded to going and covering this story because it's deepest, darkest Africa.
It's an interesting one because I consider myself a risk-averse person. You know, if there's going to be a bomb going off, I don't want to be in the middle of it. You know, I want to be safely far away. I'll report on it, but from a distance. That's why I would never be a very good photojournalist. Those guys have to take far too many risks to get the kind of footage they need. But assessing the relative risks of Ebola versus Syria, for example, Syria is violent and unpredictable, whereas Ebola is dangerous, but you know what the disease is, you know how to protect yourself, and you know what measures to put in place. You can manage that risk in a way you can't in a war zone. So I would definitely choose to go to Ebola over Syria.
Well, that being said, from what I was hearing, that if the people who do go there have to have like 50 Hazchem suits, because once you've taken it off, there's a way to take it off so that you don't contaminate yourself while taking it off. And then there's a risk to put it back on again. So you may need to discard that and put on another one. So there's that. There's the dangers of how to conduct yourself there, but there's also difficulties in getting there. I know Deborah Patter, for example, has been she is in Monrovia at the moment, but the route she had to take was like she had to go to 5 other countries to have to get there.
There are only we've looked into the Daily Maverick. We've looked into this. I would go if someone would pay for me. That's an appeal if anyone wants to pay for me. And it is crazy that the flight alone is something like 35,000 rand.
Wow.
And there's only 2 airlines that are flying in. And so basically you'd have to go via Casablanca. And to get to Casablanca, you have to take sort of a 3-legged trip anyway. And then once you're in Freetown or Monrovia, a lot of the hotels have closed down because they don't want to take the risk of being open. And also there's no business for them. So there's only sort of 1 or 2 hotels in town, which are the expensive ones. So you're looking at $200-$300 a night for the hotel room. And, very, very quickly, if you go there for a week, and this is before any of the medical precautions. I mean, if you go there for a week, you're looking at 100, 150,000 rand. And that's huge money for any media organization. Yes. Very, very few can afford it.
And we still have to have a Christmas party, Sam.
And we have to have a Christmas party. And that's, again, why... only the big foreign international organizations are going. I'm very, very pleased that Deborah Patter is going, actually. That's good.
Yeah. But then also then, once you go there, how much of an appetite is there for the pictures and reports coming out from there? Because, you know, people switch off after a while, after they see people suffering in a tent and people walking around in the Hazchem suits.
Do you think that maybe it's sort of too anonymous, the stories that come out of there? I mean, you hear the numbers and all the people who are dying, and you see the pictures of people in pain, but like, we don't really know, or at least I don't, the stories of those people. Mm. You know, what are their families going through? How do they feel about it? I think those are the types of things which grip people. And also, you know, like the one or two patients in America who have come under media spotlight, I think people over there are interested because they can relate to the people, you know, and it makes it seem closer to home.
But also because they're scared. That they're terrified that it's, right? It's a lot.
Of course, it's close. Yes. You know, and in to defend them in to some degree, you know, if there's a calamity happening in America or something, you know, we all care here to a certain degree, but as soon as there are a whole bunch of South Africans there, we care a lot more, right? Mm. And that it is always going to sort of be the case when the stories aren't coming from the people.
It is human nature. I mean, it took me a good couple of days before I realized it wasn't just 67 South Africans killed in TB Joshua's building collapse.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and obviously we're very concerned about our own. You know, but
on the other hand, that being said, for example, the Spanish nurse who contracted Ebola. Do you know the story of her dog? Then having to be put down, and there were like almost riots there because people were trying to save the dog. I mean, 4,000 people died, and you know, this is not it's not about the dog, but it's the fact is how
so people, disproportionate.
Yes, the reaction to it is completely disproportionate.
I was at a Medicine Sans Frontières, that's Doctors Without Borders press conference this morning on Ebola, and I mean, this is an organization that I know quite well. My wife actually works for them, so I sort of get an insight into their inner workings. And they are panicked. And to see some, you know, people like that, who they've dealt with Ebola, they've dealt with epidemics, they've dealt with civil wars and everything. They know their stuff, you know. These are old hands, and yet they are panicked.
Yeah,
the situation is just beyond everyone's control. And if you do want to help, I think donating to them is the best possible way, because they have by far the largest presence on the ground in Liberia and Sierra Leone. And they're running a campaign at the moment called Tough Decisions, I think. And some of the nurses, what they were saying, and doctors. One of them was you have to, if someone comes in, you can't tell immediately if they have Ebola. You know, they might describe the symptoms.
You just have like a fever.
So it's almost like a 50-50 for some of them. Some of them it's obvious and you admit them. Some of them it could just be malaria or it could be Ebola. And there's such a shortage of bed space. So you have to ration the bed space very carefully. So you have these doctors who have to then make a decision whether they think what you've described is Ebola or isn't Ebola. And if they get that decision wrong, then
that person goes back out into the
community. Either that person goes back out and infects people, or a healthy person comes into the facility and gets infected. I mean, imagine the weight of responsibility on what's a... It's a subjective test. There's no, you know...
I was watching on Sunday night, and I was flicking through all the news channels, and there was such a panic in the U.S. about this other healthcare worker who contracted it from the Liberian man in Texas. And they were calling it, I mean, the strap on every single the screen was breach in protocol, because they couldn't figure out how she picked it up, because she was fully dressed in the suit.
Sounds like a Jason Bourne movie.
Yes, I know. You wanted, because it was just so much panic. You know, you have all these correspondents lined up outside this hospital. How could this have happened with all the strict measures that were taken? And what's even scarier for them was that the guy who died was in contact with about 50 other people. So you know, now there's a complete panic of not only those 50 people, but the people, those 50 people then. So you know,
and that's how it goes. It's exponential.
Yes.
It's just suddenly just,
yes. And I mean, and that's a scary, it's so easy to cause panic in like a country like ours, where there's a constant flow of people in and out. There is obviously strict controls now, but we have a large movement of people on a daily basis. And if somebody comes in with a slight trace of it, you know, you think how rapidly it can move from there, because, you know, even with strict precautions and people being covered up, it can still be transmitted. So yeah, it is a scary thing.
And on that note, I met a foreign correspondent, a Dutch correspondent, who'd just come from Sierra Leone to Johannesburg. And of course, you can't fly direct anymore. Mm-hmm. So he had to come via Brussels, I think was his route. And he, you know, you fill in that landing card, and that's where they, you know, they ask you, I think it's a special one. And they say, have you been to any of these countries in the last? So he said, you know, just come from Sierra Leone. the immigration person took it, didn't look at it twice, put it on the counter, and he walked straight through. Imagine.
Oh, no. Yeah. I was, like, comforted by the fact that, like, you know, that they're really, really strict now.
Well, I'm sorry to take that away from you.
I wonder if that guy then later on, you know, I'm sure he'd get into trouble, you know, if it came back later that a person had been infected and he hadn't properly checked the...
You would imagine so. Hope so. I actually shook that guy's hand. Maybe that was a bad
idea. Simon, get out of the studio right now.
Yeah. And
on that high note, I think we should end the show.
Yes. Thank you, everyone. This has been the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. You can read all of our stuff on www.dailymaverick.co.za. If you're not doing that every day, you should be. You're wasting your time everywhere else.
The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com.